Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program's Foundation in Faith. We're going to look today at the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 4, verses 21 to 30. And in this Gospel, we pick up on another segment of the Gospel, which we've already talked about, and that is Jesus returning to Nazareth and going into the synagogue and performing that which was normal in the synagogue when he went home, that it was the custom that in those days that any male could go into a synagogue and could read the scroll, either the prescribed scroll of the day, or he could pick a reading of his own choosing and then comment on if he wished to. And so that's what Jesus did. He came in, we're told, however, with kind of a reputation. People had heard of all the wonderful things he had done, and they were anxious to hear him, and they were very approving, the gospel says, of what he says. For what he did was he quoted the prophecies of Isaiah, Isaiah 61, about the coming of the day of the Lord, the messianic text, in which he comes to declare a year of favor for the Lord. And that year of favor for the Lord, I think we've seen before, was really to declare a jubilee year, which in the tradition of Israel was the forgiveness of all debt. In the messianic age, it is the forgiveness of sin and the removing of the debt of sin. So it is a very, very positive and joyful kind of proclamation, a proclamation of hope, a proclamation that says that the word of the Lord will be fulfilled and the promises of the Lord will come to be, and that will bring great joy to the people. So then the gospel then we have today, it says also that when he says the text is being fulfilled today even as you listen, and we saw also that that is kind of a messianic identity, and he won the approval of all, and they were astonished by the gracious words that came from his mouth. Then it begins, however, because you can't have anything in any kind of human community. You can't just say something, and then people just nod their heads in approval and wander off carrying it in their heart. No, they began to say, "This is Joseph's son, surely." But he replied to them, for he knew where they were going, "No doubt you will quote me with the saying, 'Physician, heal yourself.' And tell me, we have heard all that happened in Capernaum. Do the same here in your own countryside." And he went on, "I'll tell you solemnly, no prophet is ever accepted in his own country." He knows exactly where the question, "This is Joseph's son, surely," is going to lead. He's a native of this town. He knows the culture. He knows the people. And it's a very common kind of thing in any kind of close group. If someone manages to rise above the crowd, there is some admiration for that, some kind of pride in the fact that they are kind of a local son or a local daughter of the community. At the same time, there's always a certain amount of jealousy and a certain amount of resentment, such as, well, why them and not me? And so that kind of human dynamic is part of the story. So after then, they raise the question, "This is Joseph's son, surely." He goes on to tell them what they're thinking. And that's really kind of interesting, too. He says, "You're going to say to me eventually, 'Heal yourself.'" And then you're going to say to me, "If you've done all these great things, why have you done them in Capernaum instead of in Nazareth?" It's like a great man coming from a great person coming from Cleveland, Columbus, or Cincinnati. They end up in one of those other cities in Ohio or Toledo, and then the ones in the local city where they come from say, "Well, you know, why doesn't he do things here? Why has he gone somewhere else to somehow or other peddle his wares?" I suppose you could say. And it's the same thing within neighborhoods within cities, and it's the same thing within ethnic communities within cities. There is this tendency to say that, "Who do you think you are?" Which is basically what happens when they say, "This is Joseph's son, surely." Basically, that is in the modern day idiom, that is, "Who do you think you are?" And so Jesus goes on and he says to them, this is what you're thinking. But let me tell you something, he says. And then he goes back once again into the Old Testament. There were many widows in Israel, I can assure you, in Elijah's day, when heaven remained shut for 3 years and 6 months and a great famine raged throughout the land. But Elijah was not sent to any one of these. He was sent to a widow at Zarephath, a Sidonian town. And then, he says, in the prophet Elisha's time, there were many lepers in Israel, but none of these were cured except the Syrian Naaman or Naaman. So basically what he's saying is, I'm going to tell you in the Old Testament where the precedent for who do you think you are is coming from. And the precedent is, remember that the poor widow of Zarephath, the one that Elijah came across, asked for a cake and something to drink, and she said, well, I have only a little flour and oil, and I'm going to bake something for my son and I, and then we're going to die of hunger. And he says to her, well, bake it for me, and you won't have to worry. And then until the rains came, the widow never again wanted for either oil or flour. And so it was a Zarephathian widow, though. It was not a widow of Israel. And the same thing we know when the great general comes from Assyria, because one of the slave girls says, there's a great prophet in Israel, and he'll take care of you. And when Elisha tells him to go wash in the Jordan 7 times, he refuses to do so. The slave girl says, you better do it. He does it. He's cured of his leprosy. He is a Syrian. So we have foreigners then receiving the benefit of the prophet's powers and the prophet's prayers. So that Jesus is saying, you're saying, who do you think you are? And basically what you're doing is following an ancient human pattern of somehow or other not really recognizing or honoring one of your own if they excel, if they rise above the crowd. And so what he does then is reminds them once again of the Old Testament precedent, of the Old Testament stories, and how, in fact, what they're seeing before them and what they have been experiencing has already been patterned for them and modeled for them in the prophetic and legal tradition of the Old Testament, and that it is a commentary, as much of the Bible is, a commentary on human nature and common human experience. Well, when they heard this, everyone in the synagogue was enraged. They sprang to their feet and hustled him out of the town, and they took him up to the brow of the hill of their town, which was built on, intending to throw them down the cliff. But he slipped through the crowd, and he walked away. An extreme case of jealousy and resentment. He has so insulted us. He has been dismissive of our concerns and of the things that we know and understand that we might as well kill him. Jesus, however, simply walks away from them. And there again, Nazareth, there is no record of Jesus visiting Nazareth again. And it is in this rejection in his hometown that, at least in Luke's gospel, he begins now his journey toward Jerusalem. So let's look at this a little bit more clearly, and let's look at this in relationship to not only the phenomenon of human nature. We've already seen that. We've already seen the fact that this is a common thing, that if we know somebody well, it's very hard for us to believe that they're extraordinary, because we also know their shortcomings, their weaknesses, and their faults. And so what we want to do then is, you know, bring them down to size and don't let them get a big head about their accomplishments or their achievements. This is kind of a human thing. It's kind of something people do. It's kind of like, just even in families, there's kind of competition sometimes and jealousy sometimes, and in communities there certainly are, so-and-so likes so-and-so better than me and all of these kinds of things. And the more important the person is within the community, the more they want to be identified with that person, while at the same time oftentimes resenting him and being angry about his or her success. But what happens here is they identify him now with Joseph, and they identify him also eventually with Joseph's trade. The thing is what they're really saying, first of all, who do you think you are? But the second thing is saying, we know you. We know where you come from. Your father was a carpenter, a local carpenter among us. How can his son then become kind of this great personality that has some kind of strange and powerful powers that can overcome the consequences of sin? And I think that's one of the things that's really something we have to be aware of in this too, that any kind of healing is the overcoming of the burden of sin in the Old Testament, of the corporate sin of humanity and the accumulative sin of humanity, which is why also when he mentions the widow and the Syrian general, even when he mentions them, what has happened is that instead of lifting the sin off the backs of the people of Israel, he has lifted them off the Gentiles. What happened then was in the Gentiles that there is a deep resentment now, especially in Galilee. And part of it is because Galilee of the Gentiles, because Galilee is torn and is divided between Jews and Gentiles. And that therefore, basically, what it seems like is that Jesus has kind of sided with their enemies, sided with the people who are not really well, good enough for them, sided with the people that were not really who they should have been. And that, as a matter of fact, not only that, but he has even moved out of his hometown and he lives in what could be considered at that time even a more cosmopolitan center, certainly not a big city, but at least a greater center than Nazareth in the town of Capernaum. And we know that it is in Capernaum, in the synagogue in Capernaum, where Jesus preaches and teaches his lessons on the bread of life. What about ourselves in all of this? Where do we fall into this story? And I think I've said before that every story is not locked into the first century. Every story is kind of an overlay of contemporary life also, as well as being an insight into the first century, because it is kind of always an insight into human nature. We've just been discussing the human nature dimensions of this kind of thing that's happened in the gospel, this kind of resistance to Jesus's greatness, and the fact that he wants to remind them and call them to account for the fact that it is this very kind of familiarity, which instead of inaugurating or initiating a great respect and fraternal love for someone, it becomes then a source of resentment and jealousy. So we've seen that. What about ourselves? Don't we experience this very same thing within our own world, in our own times, and among our own people? Hasn't it part of the problem of the modern church come because we have been so successful? We have been so deeply embedded into contemporary culture that the church has proliferated so much in the last century that certainly we had existed in every nook and cranny of American society. And that even though there were mission territories within the United States, the Missionary Servants of the Most Holy Trinity, the Glen Marys, and so forth, had formed to go into the unchurched or the churchless areas of the country, many times to the Deep South or into the West or wherever they've gone. But the fact of the matter is that we have been a pervasive presence within American society for the majority of all of our lives. Even those who are younger, who are experiencing some way the contraction of this vast network of Catholicism. It is where they can go. Wherever they go, they will find the presence of the church, even now, even yet. Maybe in a much diminished form, maybe in not quite so, might not be thriving, might not be quite so full in the churches or any of those kinds of things. But nevertheless, you don't go anywhere, basically almost nowhere, where there is nowhere for the Catholic Church to exist, for the Catholic world to exist. Whereas that could be something that makes us very pleased and happy, at the same time, it also has grown very common to us. It has been oftentimes taken for granted. We take, for instance, some of the examples of modern Catholicism, where the whole thing really doesn't seem to run very deep, where the whole thing really is not a very profound encounter, a profound experience. It is, in fact, instead of that, it becomes kind of, well, yawn. It's always there. And I think I'll just do my own thing and occasionally drop in because somewhere in the back of my mind I do have a recollection that perhaps somehow or other in receiving the Eucharist, the God himself comes into my life. And so what happens is then we have this vast falling away from the church. Part of it is that familiarity has bred contempt. Because when the church has become as extensive as the church is for us in our day, there is also going to be riddled with human weaknesses, which are also pervasive and which also have a very, very high profile within the society in which we live. And so we can see, for instance, exemplary lives of Christians, of Catholics. We can see many committed lay people in the parishes. We can find very committed priests and sisters still carrying with them the great gift of the faith. But we can also see a great crowd of the others, of the ones who have become too familiar with it, of the ones who take it not seriously enough, of the ones who decide, well, we don't have to listen to what Jesus says. We can make up our own world because the only thing we know about Jesus is that he was nice to everybody. And so if we do that, then we're truly followers of the Christ. Or if we embed ourselves in kind of an improving relationship with the society in which we live and solve all of its problems, at least in our minds and our conversations, then somehow or other, we certainly are some of the better people. Isn't that the way it is? Isn't that in some way, shape, or form what's going on in the gospel? We know who he is. He's Joseph's son. His mother's Mary. We know his relatives. We know who they are. He lived here all his life. Of course we're familiar with him. Of course we know who he is. Of course he was a good guy. Of course he was a nice guy. But this, who is he now to do this? And then to turn around and say that he can't do it here or won't do it here, and then insults us with stories from the Old Testament. Who is this? It's not anyone we want in our town. And so the movement begins then to get rid of him. I think that in the church today, we find the very same thing. We find, for instance, those who say, well, I know all about this. After all, I grew up three blocks down from the church. After all, I went to Catholic grade school. After all, I did this or I did that. I made my first communion. I was confirmed. But what is all this business that you're talking about? What is all this pro-life business? What is all this business about our obligations to one another and our obligations to the Lord God? What about that? Who are you to tell us what to do? Who are you to say that we should be doing this or doing this, or we can't do this or we can't do that? After all, you know, I'm a free person and I can make up my own mind and no one should be telling me what I can do and what I can't do. All of that is an attitude that develops from over-familiarity, which leads to contempt. And every time someone within the church, lay, clerical, or religious, who says those kinds of things about obligation, about mystery, about about all of those kinds of things, about our relationship with God, how we're not autonomous beings, how we have an accountability to the source of our being, just as we have an accountability to anyone who loves us and whom we love, and so forth, that any time that all of this comes up and comes out of the mouth of someone who really is just saying it but doesn't live it, doesn't feel it, doesn't believe it, doesn't witness to it, doesn't model it, then all of it becomes like, oh, well, no one takes it serious anyway, so why should I? It takes us back to the example, too, of St. Francis Xavier in his missionary trip to the Far East. The first place he went in the Far East was the island of Goa, which was a Portuguese colony off the coast of India. Today, it's a part of India. And when Francis Xavier went there, his intention was to bring Christianity to the natives. But he writes back to Saint Ignatius Loyola and says, I can't do it because the lives of the Christians are so scandalous that no one will take anything I say seriously. And that also is part of the affliction of our day, part of the affliction of our age. That no one who sees this downside of the church, who sees this kind of negative side of the church, how can you take seriously the proclamation of the gospel? These people were committed to proclaiming the gospel just as the Portuguese colonists were committed to living the Christian life. And in both cases, neither thing resonated as authentic or true or integral to their lives and to the society in which they live. That basically is one of the greatest crimes of the abusive structures that exist within the church today. It not so much, certainly, the acts themselves are heinous and reprehensible, but what they also do is they trivialize the Word of God. They trivialize the gift of faith. They trivialize the gift of sacrament. They trivialize the presence of the church and make it kind of a non-credible institution, even oftentimes among its own people. This, then, is what's happening in Nazareth. Were they truly embedded in the tradition of Israel? Were they truly embedded in the Torah, in the prophetic tradition? They would see how the prophetic tradition reached out beyond Israel to bring about forgiveness of sin and restoration of the created order. They would have seen all that. They would have rejoiced when Jesus told them that. Instead, they say, no, we're not going to rejoice. You have to do it here so that it will be our possession, so that we can see it, so that we, therefore, can appropriate it to ourselves. And in so doing, they make it so that Jesus says to them, ultimately, I can't do anything here because of your lack of faith. That because somehow or other this is not about God but about yourselves, I therefore am no longer capable of performing the signs, because the signs are there as witness. The signs are there to bring about and stir up faith. They are not signs to affirm the doubting or to bolster the ego or the sense of self-importance of those who participate in the arena of these activities. That we find, for instance, this becoming problematic all the way through the Gospels. And we know, for instance, that oftentimes the signs and the wonders created a negative in the minds of the people, because they were not concerned about the Word. They were not concerned about the forgiveness of sin. They were not concerned about the revelation of the Messiah and the revelation of the coming of the day of the Lord. They were seeking signs and wonders. They wanted a show. They wanted somehow or other to be overwhelmed with magical tricks and magical acts. Again, we see this in the Old Testament when Moses is dealing with Pharaoh, and every sign that Moses performs, and this there is intent in this in the gospel, that everything that Moses performed, that somehow or other they would find magicians who could do similar things. The idea being that the physical miracles, the physical wonders, are not actually the things that lead us into the life of the living God. We find all these, you know, all these healing shows and magic water and all of this kind of stuff. None of that is what it's all about. It is all miracles are to lead us into a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ and a deeper understanding of who he is. There are miracles around us constantly, maybe not the popular ones, maybe not the very public ones as they were in the day of Jesus, but we see them around us. We see healings that we cannot understand. We see broken relationships repaired that we cannot. We see all of that kind of thing. But what happens is that they should lead us to understand the enduring presence and benevolence and the goodness of the living God among us. When they become somehow or other a sideshow, when that happens, then it blocks out the real message of what transpires. And in the gospel, Jesus flees that. In the story of the plagues of Egypt, Moses simply gets discouraged and keeps saying, I can't do this. But then God finally shows who he truly is, and that Pharaoh cannot imitate. He is the God of life. He is the creator of life, and life is in his hands. He gives life, he takes life. For instance, this whole idea that we have a right to take life in some arbitrary sort of way, like this ghastly business in New York State that has recently transpired about allowing even a baby born somehow or other and surviving the attempt to destroy its life can be left to die on its own on a table. This is a denial of a belief in God. It is playing God in the lives of people. And it is telling each person, you are a God. From the story of Moses and Pharaoh, God is the God of life. He is the giver and the taker of human life. And that anyone who assumes that role unto themselves implicitly denies the divinity of God, implicitly denies the existence of God, implicitly then says life ultimately has no meaning. I think that what happens here in this gospel today is the beginning of the rejection that life has meaning. For God is among them. And all they think about is themselves, their local pride, their desire for somehow or other to share in the fame, their desire for somehow or other to share in the adulation of others. And Jesus refuses to do that. And so they sprang to their feet and hustled him out of the town and took him up to the brow of the hill their town was built on, intending to throw him down the cliff. How many times is Jesus rushed to the edge of the cliff with the intention of many to throw him over the edge.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.